Okay, this is talking with Ben, I believe, Hochout?
Yeah, Ben, that's...
Ben Hochout at the IAU in Montreal on 21st August 1979. Well, can you first tell me what your educational background was and then how you first came into contact with radio astronomy?
Well, the story is the following. I studied at the Technical University in Delft in Holland.
Yes.
And there we have... faculty called physical engineering,
right,
which gave me quite a background in physics, apart from a general technical education. So I touched mechanical and electrical subjects. My main interest was actually electronic engineering in that period.
Mm-hmm.
And after the war, well, during the war, of course, the whole thing was stopped. And
right.
After the war, all of us were a little bit annoyed about having done over a long period nothing at all. So we all wanted to do something, so I started working and became engaged with the postal communication laboratories in Holland.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very active group, and as the Germans had destroyed all the antennas that were used for shortwave communications, and we were in heavy need for that in view of the situation
right.
in what is now Indonesia, I got engaged in the task of rebuilding the antenna complexes, the receiving and transmitting antennas, and as there had been many bad results before the war, we did a lot of research and recalculations on
mm-hmm.
that and made larger ones. We only had very small transmitters, so you had to make very big antennas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We had nothing. It was of course you couldn't get large transmitters, and what we actually used, we used the pre-stages of the transmitters in order to have some power available, because the large stages were all blown up.
I see.
Well, anyway, that's a long story, but that's not of interest. The interesting point there is that my chiefs at the Postal Communication Laboratory got interested and engaged in, a commission which later on turned to be the well-known Foundation for Radio Astronomy in Holland. And they were members there on the board. And gradually the idea, basically supported by Van der Hulst and Oort, about building a large antenna, well, we now call it radio telescopes,
right.
Developed there. And so they were looking for, more technically oriented people.
Right.
And finally decided that they engaged two. One was Muller, who did the receiver, the electronic part of
right.
it. And I did the antenna part of it, as I was more inclined to mechanical and purely electrical engineering.
And what year now are you talking about when you first began getting involved?
I think it was somewhere around 1950 that I skipped. Well, my work at the Postal Communication Lab was more or less completed. The antennas were up, everything was working again, we got new transmitters. And so in 1950 I finally decided to get my master's degree at the Technical University.
Mm-hmm.
So for a couple of months I did an effort in that direction. And they asked at the Postal Communication Lab whether I would be willing to return. Now, this was too much of a civil service idea to me, so I said, no, I want something else. I want to go out in the world. And then somebody came up with the idea and said, why don't you talk with Oort about the radio astronomy? I didn't know anything. Well, I talked to Oort, and that was quite right, and he immediately put me up in the observatory, and I had to follow all the courses. So I got quite a bit of education in astronomy in that period.
For how long of a period were you at Leiden?
Well, very long. Stayed there in that period, not in Leiden itself, but I had to follow courses there, but still had my seat at the communication labs, which was quite in the neighborhood. Then I did a lot of search about finding a place in Holland where you could put up such a large
right.
telescope. I went to Norway and got down from the mountains a few smaller antennas that we used in the meantime, the 7.5 meter Woodsberg antennas. I got two out of them and
mm-hmm.
repaired them and remounted them in an equatorial way. And they're still in use, actually.
Now, but, were these the antennas that were used for the Kootwijk survey?
No,
I didn't think so.
Dutch one.
Those were already there.
They were there. There were two of them.
Why did you have to go to Norway?
There were none left in Holland, you know. And in Norway, they were sold for scratch. It was aluminium and
mm-hmm.
like that. But in Norway, they couldn't get them out from the mountains very easily. You know, they were
right.
mounted very high. I wrecked two, but I got two down. And so that was.
And what did you use these for?
And they're still in Dvingelo.
Yes, what were they used for originally?
We mounted two. One was immediately taken up for solar research, and the other one was used as a general pilot instrument for a while. And for instance, Jaap Baars did a lot of interferometric antenna measurements together with the large one when it was completed. It always has been on and on. At the moment, we have only one in operation because the other one was moved somewhere else again to an amateur observatory. Right. You know, they do bit of things.
What happened to the original Würzburg at Kotwijk? Was that just taken apart at some stage?
No, I think it was also given to the amateur observatory, which is there somewhere in the south of Holland. They have two of them working now, and it's not used anymore. But it may also be there's a whole history. We have five or six of these things. Some of them fell apart, and some were used to recondition the old one. So I think we now have two or three still in operation. And one of them is in Dvingelo, still a pilot instrument for a solar observatory.
Right.
You know the system. Because you have to talk to Slotje about this, but the principle is that they monitor the sun, and if there is a flare, we can change over the old Dvingelo 25 meter, change it to 400 megacycle,
right,
and still are in time to pick up the flare and do some better research on it.
But now, were you then an employee of the Stichting, the foundation?
Yes,
at that time?
I was employed by the foundation, I think somewhere from 50, 51 to, I think I left there at 56, then the 25 meter was commissioned. It was commissioned in 56.
Right.
That's about the period that we took. The first period was characterized as on a search for a place where we could put it up, because Kotwijk is a transmitting station,
right,
and we wanted to get rid of that. And we were not allowed anymore on the receiving station of the communication services. So first I went to the south, and the influence of Philips, of course, and then later on we went to the north. And the second thing was to rig up all the engineering specification for the telescope. One thing I remember is that when I got engaged in it in 1950-1951, having worked in antennas quite a bit, although even if they were only shortwave, but nevertheless you had a feeling about what this. The first thing I found is that they were using a mesh where you could put your hand straight through, you know. That
right.
was the worst shock I got. It would be have been as transparent as possible for 21 centimeters. That was one of those crazy things. Another thing was that they didn't have any idea about servo systems or the drive systems. It was all new. And I had quite a bit of access to modern literature at the communication lab, so all these things more or less was available. Well, I got the whole MIT series, all the 30
right.
ones from Bell Labs. It was just a present to all the postal engineers, you know, and things like that. So you had access to many things that were not normally known in industry.
Right.
And another thing is we didn't have any form of computer facilities for computing deformations. Nobody knew. You had to assume certain climatological conditions, wind conditions, storm
right.
conditions, icing conditions. Nobody knew, you know.
Yeah.
And it took a long while before I got the specification in such a form that I could think as being reasonable. And then I went to Lovell in England, who had the same problem with his 75 meters, and we had a lengthy discussion. We always disagreed, but nevertheless we supported each other in that way.
Now, it sounds like there were some preliminary ideas when you came on the scene.
Yes, they were. It started before 1950. It started right after the war on the suggestion of van der Hulst about the 21-centimeter Heideken line and Oortzaides to make a large antenna. So he got in contact with the...
But who had developed these? I mean...
That was an industry in Amsterdam. It doesn't exist anymore. It's called Werkspoor.
And
they
made
some initial designs, several of them, and they were guided more or less by Minnaert and Houtgast in Utrecht.
I see.
And Oort was not interested from a technological point of view, it was only interested in ARD.
Right.
What is very peculiar is that right from the beginning, on some very rough calculations, they confined the size to 25 meters. And that was a very big one. It never had been
in the late 40s,
right? Yeah. And in 56, when it was commissioned for more than half a year, or even longer than that, for nearly a year, we were the largest in the world.
Until
then,
Jarl,
of course, Lovell got
right.
his in operation early in 57. So that then he got...
Okay, if we go now to when you came on the scene in 51 or 2, what were the astronomical specifications that you had to work with from ORT, more or less?
I think they talked about a wire mesh of about 5 by 5 centimeters, a pointing accuracy somewhere around 10 minutes of arc. They talked about deformations, if possible, better than 5 centimeters. And, well, you laugh, but that's the way I found it.
Huh? Right.
And it was only on the basis of, well, the MIT books helped me a lot, you know, where there were specifications for radar antennas, that I got wise to the wire mesh, that it had to be much smaller. I ended up with, I think, 1.2 millimeter, no, 1.12 millimeter, yeah, 12 millimeter mesh, you know, and which later on, later reconditioning stage, we changed now to 8 millimeters.
That was in the late 60s, though.
That was in the late 60s, okay. Much later on. The idea of wire mesh and the whole behavior, we did measurements on it, but I found a lot in the MIT books. And then the whole principle of surface system, pointing accuracy, dish accuracy of being somewhere around 10th to a 20th of a wavelength. And what is also very important, and this I followed that through my whole life, that they asked specification of 21 centimeters. But I always had in mind, well, you never know, you know, they may ask for something more. So everything was specified for 21, but I tried in every aspect to get it, the specification working for 10 centimeters. And I think they were very happy with all this. The same applied later on for Westerbork also, which at the moment they're happily operating at 6 centimeters. So. But there were many things, for instance, a rail track, this wheel on track system which we have. Nobody knew anything about that, you know.
Yeah.
We didn't know even what friction was. Everything had to be measured just by experiments to see what was necessary.
Well, first of all, what about the decision to not to have an Altaz mount rather than equatorial?
In that period, there was no discussion about equatorial at all. They couldn't envisage that at all. It was all Altaz mounts.
The Dwinglo one. Of course, many years later, the 140-foot Greenbank didn't make that decision. I mean,
no, they went to equatorial. Well, actually, the Westerbork ones are equatorial also.
Right. So, I mean,
but then
why,
I knew
what was
a lot
your
more.
What was your reasoning to make it Altaz?
It was already Altaz when we started on. They had the example of the Würzburg dish, you know, and that was Altazimuth. So the original design was just an enlargement of the Würzburg one.
I see.
And gradually it grew, and when I came in, this was the first time that somebody looked it over from a pure antenna point of view.
Except the Würzburg was solid surface, though.
No, it was also not wire mesh, it was punched metal. But they never understood why it was made as narrow as that.
It was quite correct.
Yeah. But I think it was just available during the war and it worked. And they thought that they could get around with much larger mesh, basically because they had so much trouble in the wind forces. But to give you an idea, I think the weight in the period when I redesigned the whole thing in 51, 52, the wind, the weight of the whole structure tripled, more or less. Because, well, I had to build up steel in order to combat the wind forces.
Yep.
The wind forces were raised because we had narrower mesh.
Right.
Well, I remember that I had to find a wind tunnel to do wind force measurements on the mesh and things like that.
Right.
We didn't know how it was as a function of angle, nothing. All the things are available at the moment. And no computer, of course, for the structural analysis. We had nothing.
Why did the province of Drenthe turn out to be a better site than in the south of Holland, where you had some hills?
Well, the basic reason was that just south of Holland, south of Eindhoven, where we were talking about, there was a huge US airfield with radar equipment. So that chased us off there. And the second thing is that...
Speaking of getting chased...
So we moved to the north because it was a very quiet area. It's not anymore, but anyway, it's still far more quiet.
But also, of course, it's very flat, which means it's more interference than if you had to do
that. Well, yes, we were very concerned because it was a single telescope that we could look at the nuclei of our galaxy.
In the south, right.
And we are 52 degrees latitude, so we really have to go south.
That's true.
And we have a very nice field there over
the
nature
hydro,
reservation, you know. Lots of trouble, of course, with these nature preservation people, you know. But finally, they were most happy with us because we now form the guarantee that nothing is going to be done in that area.
Right.
So at the moment we were very, very happy.
Right.
I remember that when it was completed that somebody came up and says, "Now I want to have the whole thing painted dark green." I just had painted it light grey in view of the sky, you know, and then they wanted dark green. Finally I said, "Well, okay, you do it yourself, you pay for it, so it's still light green." But
okay, so what other, as the construction of the telescope began and Were there any particular difficulties, or did it all go pretty smoothly?
It went off pretty smoothly in the end. I think we did enough preparations. It took a long time. We talk about 1950 to 1956 to do the final engineering and manufacturing. I think most things went off quite well. We had a few things about fitting. We had a few troubles about the wire mesh. In that period, there was no stainless steel or welded stainless steel, so we used a tint procedure providing soldering to all the joints of the wire mesh, things like that, you know, that they had to be experimented on. But generally, it worked out pretty smoothly. We had some crazy difficulties in adjusting the surface, not because it was so very difficult, but people made mistakes, and everything had to be done on a hand calculator. Mm-hmm. And they made mistakes, you know, you have several thousand points. And so after the first run, we found it was wrong, and actually much later on, we found it still was wrong. So it was readjusted in 1965, actually, mm-hmm. after we put up new paneling. And we
and you were more concerned about the higher frequencies also.
Did the whole thing again, and since then it's better. It was a slight astigmatism, it was not so serious in the beginning. But you had, for instance, ridiculous troubles that nobody could provide the servo system, so I had to rely on our naval laboratory in Holland, where they had some experience with gun mounts. I remember being on warships to see how they manage with that thing, all English techniques, metropolitan figures they called it originally, and all sorts of tricks that you had to use, because we wanted high accuracy. Of course, at the moment it's all standard, you know.
Right, sure.
And that was, therefore, from an engineering point of view, it was a very interesting project, simply because everything you touched upon was new. Huh? And sometimes it was pretty difficult to convince structural engineers that it had to be done in a different way. Mm-hmm. Huh?
Were there any other people that you were talking to at that time beside Lovell's group that were building large antennas?
Most of my contacts with Lovell. No, only in 55, I think, I was invited in Germany, because they were then working on the Stocker 25 meter, and they ran into the same trouble that they couldn't find people with control engineering. And also what was typical development in that period is what I call the mechanical coordinate transformer, because it was an altazimuth mount.
Right.
And so I developed this firm in Holland, which was a very old acquaintance, I think, from the observatory in Leiden. Before the war, they once built something of a small optical telescope, so they knew what equatorial was, you know. Otherwise, they didn't know anything at all.
Right.
Then I got the example of the coordinate transformer, which they used on the 50 meter of the Naval Observatory in Washington. I got pictures.
The NRL 50 foot.
NRL 50 foot, yes. And That has never performed quite well, so I started redesigning, making models, plastic models, I remember, and then turned the whole thing inside out. And finally, with that small firm, there was a very good mechanical engineer there, we finally did something of which is very peculiar. Five have been made for all sorts of observatories in the world. The second one went to Bonn.
Yes.
And then after Dwingeloo was finished, we made two of these antennas for England, for Hay.
Two of Royal these Radio transformers, Stubbies. You mean?
No, the whole antenna, including the transformers and the drive. Oh, you mean a Defford airfield, the near Malvern.
I see.
Yes. Oh, hey, you must
right.
remember.
Right, well, sure, I know the Malvern, but I didn't know that. Yeah. You're saying there's a copy of the Dwingeloo antenna.
Yes, and
there.
They're only on a carriage and can be moved. It's very modern, because all of us are now making moving antennas.
But when you say in Bonn.
In Bonn it was a fixed one, and I did the coordinate transformer there and the control engine.
Right, but not the antenna.
Not the antenna, right. No, that was mechanical stuff which was made in Germany.
And where else did these Dwingeloo designs go?
And then the antenna design went to England, two of them, including two control transformers. And the final control transformer went to Air Force Cambridge Research Labs there in Massachusetts. And, it was used by Aarons.
Right.
He got one. I don't think it any works. All of them are not being put in a museum, you know.
Sure,
digital control. But we reached, I think it's still a nice piece of engineering, we reached in that period with I call them cells in synchros, you would say, in the States. We reached 1 minute of arc accuracy in the coordinate transformation. This was pretty good, you know. NRL never reached that. They got stuck somewhere between 5 and 7 minutes of arc. But we reached 1 minute of arc, and it has been in operation until 1.5 years ago in Dwingeloo. I just learned that in Bonn they have now skipped it also. there's no digital.
I didn't realize actually that it was the same system up until only a year ago, the same early system. Now, when the antenna was first operating in 1956, did it meet all of the specifications?
Generally, the thing performed quite well, yes. Mm-hmm. There were a few problems about the alignment of wheels, and we fiddled around a bit with the servo system. We had some trouble in the coupling of the synchros to the axis and things like that, but it was all minor debugging, you know.
Yeah.
But basically, the whole thing performed quite well, and what the changes that were made, well, it was a prototype, but the changes that were made, we had a central tube extending to the prime focus. It's a prime focus antenna. And a central tubular thing with, you know, with sky wires.
Right, yes. A mast.
That's English, then you can call it that way. That is a pretty bad system. It was weak. And so later on, actually, I didn't. Somebody else took the courage to change that and put in a tripod in the form of aluminium spar system. And it was pretty. No, it was glass fiber. Oh, yeah, glass fiber. But it was pretty bad. So. Again, a couple of years later, when then I got connected with the foundation because I'd been away to the States and South America and things like that. I got connected with it again, then more on a consulting basis. And so I ripped that out and put in a new quadrupod now. It's an aluminium quadrupod.
Right.
And that is still in.
And then what year now are you talking about?
I'm still a consulting engineer officially.
But what year did you put that in?
I forgot, but it was later in the 60s, 65 or something like that, together with the reconditioning of the reflector surface. It was a pretty heavy decision because either the whole thing had to be scrapped or we had to recondition it.
Right.
Finally, it was reconditioned. It's still in operation
as
a test bed for all sorts
of things. And doing some useful observations itself, too.
Even sometimes they're using it, so I'm most happy with that one.
Now, having done the Duingelo dish, of course, then immediately work began on what was called the Benelux Cross, which eventually became Westerbork. Were you involved in the antenna?
Yes, right from the beginning.
Aspects of that
there
also?
There were two groups in the foundation. Well, if you want to hear the whole story,
the whole story, but the beginning parts of it anyway.
But the beginning is the following. We had the 21-centimeter Muller group working on hydrogen line. Quite apart from that, there was another guy, well-known Charles Seeger, who always worked on 400 megacycles. He had a lab in Leiden. And he also worked with the Duingelo bomb, basically for absolute gain calibration, on which he used the horn, an experiment he did later on in Green Bank, and this has been one of his features. I mentioned this because it's the start of 400 megacycles. All his technique was on 400 megacycles. And part of that was later on also brought into the 25 meters, so there were two sets of rack, 21 centimeters light gray and dark green, that was Charles Seeger, 400 megacycles. Now this 400 megacycle affair determined the initial design for the Benelux Cross, because Charles Seeger started it actually, the whole basic idea, although he fell out of the project later on when he returned to the States. But that was the reason why the Benelux Cross started on 400 megacycles. Mm-hmm. And it was already fairly ambitious because in Cambridge they were still working on 127. This went a long way, and that was just before the 60s, the whole study group, and I made all sorts of mechanical design. There's somewhere in the New York Annals Annals of the Academy of Sciences of New York, I still have an overview article. I don't have a copy here, but I think you can find it.
About what year is that?
I forgot, of course, but if you ever want to have the reference on this, then and that describes all these reports. There's also an OECD report about it, but even I don't have that one.
Well, the OECD one I know, but I don't know about this New York Academy.
But right after that.
Okay.
I think it's early 60 that I make an overview article. It's the same volume which contains all the things about the 120 meter for
Sugar
Naval,
Grove,
Sugar Grove Fair, and Green Bank. That volume, that's... But anyway, there's an overview in it. But first we started with very long cylindrical affairs, first symmetrical, then asymmetrical, stretched wires affair. I made the whole engineering for that. And then gradually, well, then Charles fell out and many other people came in, the Australians came in, Christensen,
Ericsson,
and things like that, on and on and on. And finally we ended up with high cost, with
the lack of cooperation from the Belgium because they had no money, difficulty of finding a site near the Belgian frontier. Well, that's the south of Holland again, is the whole trouble of heavy development there. So the cooperation with Belgium again was hazardous in that period, and at a certain moment, during a crisis somewhere, political crisis in Belgium and in Holland, it was decided that the Belgian couldn't do it for the next 3 or 4 years.
Right.
And in Holland it was decided, well, there happened to be some many million guilders, and so just would got it. I still remember that he came out of The Hague and he phoned me in the evening and said, you have to start right now because we got 50 million guilders and now we have to build it.
Who said this?
Well, the first thing, of course, was that...
Who said that?
Hort.
Hort,
yeah. Well, I've always worked under him very strongly. You know. But the peculiar point is that we got 50 million, but the original design was for 30 million. And so it was obvious that we could not build the original 5 kilometer, 400 megacycle affair. We had to make it smaller. And then Oort says, well, of course, you can make it smaller if you move to higher frequencies. So if you got, body got jittery and says specifications and synthesis and phase locking and all sorts of things. But then I'm already talking about the early 60s.
Right.
And then with the super synthesis ID, Hertzsprung was already then in...
It was basically because there was less money available that it had become somewhat smaller. And this meant going to higher frequencies to maintain
the resolution. Because the resolution was the basic.
And then at that stage, it changed to dishes because you were going to higher frequencies.
We were already considering dishes as an alternative to the long stretched wire cylindrical affair.
Even at 408.
It gave more flexibility and it gave tracking possibilities.
I see.
That is a sensitivity question. But the resolution still being the same. And there once has been an initial design for 100 dishes of 30 meter, good for 75 centimeter. You'll find the same thing in the annals of the New York Academy of Sciences that it is all described.
Mm-hmm.
100 dishes. Mm. And but then gradually it became an impossible financially project. And therefore, the end of it was that, well, Oort, of course, was always very concerned about the 21 centimeter line. And the same applied to Meller, who was doing the electronic development in Holland for the receivers. And he always emphasized that 21 centimeter was the most important wavelength. So, and Charles had left already for
right.
the States. So this whole 400 megacycles gradually changed over. We talked
right.
about an intermediate frequency, but finally it went down to 21.
What was the critical thing that changed it from a cross to a line array? Would you say?
Well, I think the cross is typically something which can only track for a limited period of time. In that period, one wanted to have a very redundant array, you could call it, and there was still the idea that it basically interferometry that you needed to have a north-south and an east-west arm. It was only when Hertzsprung came from Cambridge, where the supersynthesis had been mm-hmm. developed. Well, actually, Hertzsprung took a large share in the development himself, in the basic ID, although Ryle claims it, of course. But that the ID came up that we didn't need the north-south. And now, once that you skip the north-south, you have the necessity to track for 12 hours with the east-west arm. Now, a cylindrical fair can't do that.
Right.
So the next step was to consider whether we could have partial tracking and an only partial north-south affair and all sorts of arrangements have been
right.
worked out. And but that came up to the 110 aerials again, of 100 telescopes, you would say now. And so I think from the moment that we decided to have less money and go to higher frequencies, we required better engineering, therefore higher cost per unit, so we had to compromise on the number of units. And so you see that then the
right.
supersynthesis came in. And I can remember that when it was much later, 65, when we went to tendering, that the